keeping all of this going all the time I've been talking to you? In other words, most of the time you have been in this room, you have been busy listening and identifying with yourself as a listener. At no time that I have been in this room have I been identifying myself as a speaker. It's a hard one. That is, there is a place inside that I am sitting where I am watching him speak. Just as I am watching him listen. And this is all happening. I don't think who I am is what's speaking. Speaking is. It's going on at the same level you all do, which you drive cars, most of you. When you put that on base brain, you do it on automatic. You can drive a car and sit and talk to somebody else and make these fantastically complex responses. Make all kinds of judgments, and you never think about it at all. And your mind's somewhere else. Well, now, where is your mind? It's usually on something else. And that something else can become secondary, and you can be on something else. You can be scratching yourself and driving and talking. And then you can be scratching, smoking, driving, and talking. And you can get so that you're doing a dozen things, none of which are conscious. Well, the idea is you find a place. You start to localize in on a place inside you where the flame never flickers. Candle place inside where the flame never flickers. And you sit in that place. Absolute calm, content, centered. From which your drama goes by. There are your desires. Wow, look at that one. There's that thought. There's that fear. Personality becomes like clothing. Body becomes like clothing. And behind it all, here I am. And I can make the statement to you that if you were centered in that inner place in you, and I in me, the thought out thing is we would be one, because there is only one inner place. And sometimes in a room, you can experience a psychic space that we are all sharing, independent of the little drama that we're playing and talking. I can look into somebody's eyes and continue to talk to them while looking into their eyes and in effect say, here we are, we have this contact, and then there is this contact of talking, you're listening, I'm speaking, and we're both watching that. It's like when Englishmen play tennis, and they're right at the set point. And it's add in or add out. It's a very critical point, and it's a fierce tennis match. And just as the serve's about to start, they look at each other, and they are so conscious that at that point they say, wow, isn't this great? And here we are fighting fiercely under this beautiful sun and playing this exquisite game. In other words, they are simultaneously living at two levels, a level which is meta to the game role which they're involved in. Well, finally, you live in a place that is meta to all the roles you live in. You live meta to your body. You live meta to your desires, meta to your feelings. And you start to center in a place. And once you live in that more and more and more, attachments keep falling away. That doesn't mean actions fall away, but attachment to actions fall away. And then all these next steps start to happen. This has been an adventure for me to share these experiences because when I came back from India, I had to come back because I still had attachments back in the West. I had to come back and live out my karma, so I was ready to come back to India. When I asked what I was to do in America, they said, do your sadhana, your spiritual work. And I said, what does that include? And they said, everything you do. And I was told that I just would do, and everything would take care of itself. So when I'm asked, I speak. When I'm not, I sit in the cabin. People come, I teach. And what is awesome to me is that as I come back, there are literally, as I go around the country, hundreds of thousands of people who are ready to hear just exactly the thing that I'm involved in. Not because it's me, but because there is a simultaneity of opening in thousands of people in Vancouver, San Francisco, Chicago, New Mexico, New York. And the thing that is further awesome to me is that all my categories of who we are and who they are break down. A whole models of generation gaps and good guys and bad guys, it all turns out to be crap. Because behind it all, here we are. Carl Jung said in his eulogy of Richard Wilhelm, who translated the I Ching, he said, it takes somebody who is willing to give up the Western predisposing perceptual framework sufficiently to experience another orientation towards the universe to be able to know what needs to be known outside of one's own system. You've got to give it up first. And what I felt is there has been a surrender of my Western model of who I am and how it all works. At the moment, I don't have a desire yet to bring it back into science or to know I know. I am a student. I'm a beginning student in this whole process. And as I understand it, finally, one teaches by one's being. It isn't what you say. It's the state of your own existence, because that's a whole level of interpersonal relations about vibrations and what you communicate to other people. Not what you say, but what you say.
Death as a vehicle for awakening, with Ram Dass. He talked recorded live at the Symposium of the American Association of Humanistic Psychology in San Rafael, California, in October of 1977.
I have to confess at the outset that while my vehicle is words, I don't really believe anything I say, because the nature of my work concerns the spaces between the words rather than the words themselves. For I'm dealing with an area, a realm of human existence that is basically not conceptual. And I'm faced with the predicament of trying to convey a non-conceptual realm through concepts. So I must ask you at the outset to take my words with a grain of salt. If you don't like them, don't worry about them. They will pass quickly. In order to understand the stages of life and ultimately the process of dying, one has to have a context in which to understand these things. And the context usually is defined as, what is the meaning of it? What am I doing here on earth? Because having an understanding of one's function or purpose makes one understand whether some process that's going on in transformation is functional or dysfunctional, or not it's useful or not. And I think none of us are so naive at this point, certainly not in this gathering of professionals and people related in related fields. None of us are so naive as to think that only that which gives pleasure is useful. I think most of you now have found through your own experiences that there is incredible growth through suffering. That doesn't mean that we would go around programming suffering into people's lives. We don't give suffering 101. And yet, when we look back at our own lives, we see some of the most profound changes occurred at the times of the most intense suffering. And the nature of the suffering is that we are confronting a situation which is dissonant or disparate from the model we have of how reality ought to be. And that's really what the cause of suffering is. The cause of suffering is the place in your mind that's defining how you think it ought to be. So if you think things should be a certain way and they're not, then there's a discomfort and you suffer. And a lot of what our suffering has been is not due to the actual characteristics of the situation, but to the way in which we perceive the situation. And that perception is based on our contextual understanding of who we are and what we're doing here. So that I must delve a little bit more into the philosophical underpinnings of your and my existence for us to have an appreciation of what the seasons of our lives, particular reference to dying, how to perceive them, how to understand them in a useful way. I'll paint a scenario, just give you a little example of what I went through in some of my processing. I'm in Benares, the city of dying in India. In the Hindu religion, the highest way in which you can die is to die in Benares. And when you die in Benares, your body gets burned at the burning ghat, and the bones and ashes get thrown into the Ganges River. And through that simple act, you are spiritually freed, and we'll talk in a minute about what that might be about. The result of that belief system is that Benares is full of people dying. And most of these people have no money whatsoever. They are beggars at the most extreme states of survival. Many of them are lepers. They have a loincloth, man or woman, just a loincloth, and maybe a begging bowl. Many of them have advanced states of cancer. Many of them are just skin and bones. They are dragging themselves through the streets. And often on their loincloth, there is a little sack which contains the money necessary for the wood for their funeral pyre. Now, if you think of yourself as a human being and think of them as a human being and empathize for a moment with their predicament, when I first came to Benares, when I went out in the streets, I was in a very open space. And when I looked at these people, I experienced such horror. I couldn't really handle it at all. And I went back to my hotel room, and I am somewhat embarrassed to admit, I literally climbed under the bed. I hid under the bed, just in horror of the situation. Because I walked through the streets with my American Express traveler's check in my pocket, with my security, with my ticket back to affluent America, and I was facing these other human beings in the extreme state of need and poverty. And my pity was more than I could handle. Subsequent to that, I met my spiritual teacher, and my whole life took a different turn, and I ended up living in a temple, studying Hindu philosophy, doing deep meditation, hatha yoga, and so on. I began to understand a different context about what life and death was about. And now, about six or eight months later, I found myself in Benares again. And I walked through the streets. And this time, it was an entirely different experience for me. But when I looked into the eyes of these people, I saw in them, not what I expected to see in the past, not self-pity, not frustration, not humiliation, not anger, not pleading. They had a look in their eyes of fulfillment. And then I noticed something else in their eyes that I could hardly believe. They were looking at me with pity. They were pitying me. Healthy, fat, solid American me. These people in the last stages of life were pitying me. And I understood that from their belief system, they were pitying me because I was merely this wanderer wandering through life, not knowing where I was going or where I was coming from. They knew their place, they were secure in their place, they were fulfilled in what they were about to do, and they knew that I was wandering in despair and I would never find, and they just felt sorry that I was so lost. And I had trained enough so that I could see it from their point of view, and I ended up feeling self-pity. Now, to me, that's an example of how a belief system can be so strong that it can take what could be called a sad tune and make it into a happy tune. It can change the entire meaning of a situation. In the villages in India where I live quite a bit of the time, there are many beings who make 2, 3, 4 rupees a day. That's 40, 60 cents a day. And they have one meal a day, and they live maybe under a railroad bridge or crowded together. Not optimum living conditions. But sometimes when I look at their faces, I experience a quality of their being that seems more in tune or in harmony with the universe than I find in the face of somebody who is affluent, successful, everything in the West. And I understand, once I get over my arrogance, of super race arrogance, that we have a great deal to learn about the dignity of the processes of life and death, the way of understanding them in a way to release us rather than to torment us. I have to digress briefly to just share with you my own sequence of perceptual shift a little bit so that you can appreciate the kinds of things I want to talk to you about. Well, I was trained as a social scientist. I was a professor. I was actually part of a junta at Harvard to protest against the soft and mushy conditions of the clinical social psychology one, social relations. I was one of those guys in favor of harder statistics. Kind of guys you love, right? I just felt that anybody that didn't know how to do a factor analysis and a chi-square just hadn't yet awakened. And though I played that game as hard as I knew how, for all the points I knew how to collect, there was in me, despite my psychoanalysis, very gnawing uneasiness that I was missing something, a malaise. And when we experience a malaise in our culture, we tend to treat that malaise as if it is our fault. We treat it as if it's our neurosis, and it's our lack of adaptability to the existing culture, which must be right because there's so many of them. And I kept trying to readapt my being to fit into the gratification patterns that the culture was offering me. And it just wasn't working. And I started to drink more. And I started to get more extreme in my ways of seeking pleasure. In order to gain the kind of fulfillment to give me a feeling of well-being. Well, then I got for some years into experimentation with psychotropic chemicals, chemicals that alter consciousness. And that changed my head around a great deal. I saw through those experiments that perhaps my malaise, my discomfort, was not just my pathology, but it was a deeper something in me attempting to awaken. And that maybe instead of treating it as some sickness that ought to be treated as a problem, I should see it as something graceful, to be honored. Maybe it would be useful to allow my life to adapt, to tune to those feelings of wrongness or rightness within myself. And I did that, and I just let my life go in the course it would naturally take, responding to an inner intuitive sense of right. Okay, that's all right. And it took me through, away from academia, it took me through psychedelic chemicals, it took me to India, it took me into yoga, and it brought me back to America, and it took me into a different kind of a perceptual view of the universe. And I found, much to my surprise, that through whatever had happened to me in these past 15 years, whatever had happened to me had very profoundly, in the real sense of alteration, had profoundly altered my feelings about death, and as a result, my feelings about life. It had very profoundly altered the definition of who I think I am. Now, I could try to very gently take you into the space translating, but instead of doing that, I'm going to do a much more shock treatment process. I'm just going to tell you how I see the world. And many of you will say, that is absolute rot. And that's perfectly okay. You have total license to reject it. But anything less than that would be dishonest on my part. So I'm going to go for broke. We'll let the chips fall where they will. And I'll even be more outrageous by telling you that what I'm presenting to you is not a belief system. It's the way things are. See, already you're shackled up. But what can I do? Anything less would be dishonest. I just got to play. You've got to know people like me exist. To the extent that I am anything at all, and that we can open for question in a little while, we could consider me as a separate entity, a set of predisposing characteristics. It would be like a DNA code that will make it psychic instead of physical. I am a set of characteristics, a program that is manifesting by taking a human birth at this time. I have taken a birth into a body. And that body has with it a personality. I've taken birth into a personality, and that personality is in a body. And I am going through a set of experiences, which is called living life. And these experiences have a certain function. These experiences, if used consciously and intentionally by me, are vehicles through which I can awaken to who I am in truth. Let me take you through an example I often use, just another little metaphorical image and analogy. Imagine, for example, that you have next to your eyes a little control switch. And you look at another human being on channel one. And what you see when you look at the other human being is a physical body. Man, woman, old, young, fat, thin, pretty, handsome, ugly, interesting. If you're a scientist, you might call them mesomorphs, ectomorphs, and endomorphs. Okay. It's a matrix of individual differences on physical plane. It's the plane of standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. It's that reality. Now let's just say you're looking at another person and you flip your television receiver one channel. Now you look at another person and what you see is their psychology. Oh, you're a manic depressive. Oh, you're a happy person. I wish I was happy like you. People in psychotherapy will live on this channel usually. They're totally preoccupied with their own depressions, elations, fears, anxieties, loneliness, hopes, etc. And that's reality. That's the real you. And the physical body is merely the carrier of that. Let's flip it again. Flip it again and you look at another person, and if you are so trained to be able to see on this channel, you would say, oh, I know who you are. You're a Libra. I can tell because of the look. You're a Sagittarius. On this channel, on channel 3, there's only 12 beings in the universe and various permutations of them. You are now seeing what could be known as the astral identity of an individual. You're seeing another plane of reality. You're seeing another way of looking at individual differences. These are three ways of looking at individual differences, three matrices, if you will. But now you flip the dial once more. It starts to get interesting. Now if you flip the dial and look into another person's eyes, you flip the dial inside your own being and look into another person's eyes, what you see is another being looking back at you. Inside an astral configuration, a personality, and a body. You in there? I'm here. How did you get into that one? And you see what the Christians call soul. You see another soul. You see another being, just like you. No different, just like you, just another being. And that you see that all the individual differences are all of the stuff in which this being is encased. Now, you could almost be comfortable with that one, but we unfortunately must flip the dial a few more times. I mean, I must take you the whole journey. You flip the next dial, and what you see when you look into someone else's eyes is you see yourself looking at yourself, looking at yourself. Because on that plane, there is only one obvious. It is one awareness that is in a multiplicity of forms. And finally, if you will allow me to flip the dial just once more, if you haven't given up completely yet, you flip the dial once more, and you disappear, and I disappear, and the dial disappears. And we're dealing with what the Buddhists call void. Or in the New Testament, before the Word. That is, before the vibratory uniqueness. Or why God is not able to be spelled in the Hebrew religion. It's unspeakable, unknowable, unseeable, unconceivable, inconceivable. Okay, now of all of these channels on the television set, who are you? Which one do you want to settle for? You want to be middle-aged? How about that one? I mean, I'm middle-aged. I guess I'm middle-aged. I have a 47-year-old body. It's like I have also a 1974 Dodge van. But you say to me, who are you? And I don't say I'm a Dodge van. Why do I choose to identify with this? Well, if I don't pick body, should I pick personality? I'm somebody on the path. That's a good one to be. I'm a curious person. I'm curious about the future. That's a good one. I'm a responsible person. Well, I'm kind of wild. I'm lazy. I'm working on myself. These are all different psychological takes of who one is. Each plane, each turn of the dial has a different statement of your identity, and each one is getting into a more and more profound place. Now when we come back to who am I, which channel are you talking about? If we start from the top and go on down into the grosser planes, I am the void who manifests as the one, who becomes the many, who has a unique set of factors to work out through a unique astral, psychological, and physical body. That's what I'm doing on earth. I have taken a body to do certain work. And when I finish that work, I will drop that body. We are dealing here with the issues of karma and reincarnation. Now, in the West, after the councils of Trent, Constantinople, and Nicaea, anywhere from 200 to 500 AD, these ideas were roughly thrown out of Christianity because they didn't make the church a workable situation. Because when you had reincarnation and karma, every human being became their own priest because it was between you and God. And for the church to keep its own control and see its function as keeping people morally living properly, it had to get rid of those concepts. Have I taken birth before? I have no experiential knowledge of that. But from where I'm sitting, undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. Will I take birth again? Undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. I have to tax your brain with one more difficult concept. As long as we were dealing with your body, with your personality, with your astral identity, or with your soul, we were dealing in time. Time passes, things change. The minute we got up into the higher plane than that, in the one, there is no time anymore. Time is relative. Now we're dealing with the place where when you know yourself as that, you just are. You are going nowhere, and you are coming from nowhere. The Zen master says your going and coming is nowhere but where you are. Now, if you can start to sense, I mean, you don't have to believe what I'm saying, just because it's the way the universe looks to me, but if you could empathize just enough to appreciate how it would be to be looking at the world from this point of view, to imagine what it's like to see your life as so functional to your awakening and your death equally so, that the whole business becomes merely a process of growth and awakening and opening and deepening and clearing and shifting channels. And there's no problem about transition. There's no holding on out of fear. It's just opening. Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint, was dying of cancer. And he had great miraculous powers, and his devotees said to him, Bhagwan, Ramana Maharshi, heal yourself. And he says, no, this body's used up. And they said, don't leave us, don't leave us. And they started to cry. And he said to them, don't be silly, where could I go? That's like me saying, I'm selling my Dodge van, and you're saying, don't leave, don't leave. I'm not leaving, I'm just selling my Dodge van. Could you imagine conceiving of death from that point of view? I have a project going, working with terminally ill people, and I've had to sit through many horrendous moments in hospitals, sitting with somebody who's dying, where the doctors come in with a cheerful, you're looking better, and then walk out in the corridor and say, won't live the night. And the person is surrounded by doctors, nurses, relatives, all of whom are so frightened of death, ministers, rabbis, so frightened of death, that there is a surrounding hysterical denial of the process, leaving the person at the moment when they need most to be able to share what's happening to them, a total void of that kind of compassion. And I'm sure most of you have seen those situations and many of us have participated in them, not knowing quite what else to do. And the hospice movement has done an incredible amount to change the image of dying. They are doing for dying what home deliveries and so on, and bringing the husbands into the hospital during the deliveries, is doing for birth. It's bringing it out of the closet. Suddenly we're getting over a Victorian uptightness. It's now suddenly true that human beings do not only eat, but they go to the toilet. Bet you never knew that. And they are born and they die. In India, it's very far out because it's all right out front. When somebody dies, they wrap them in a sheet, and sometimes in a little village, they'll put them in a rickshaw to take them to the burning god. And there's a dead being sitting in a rickshaw on the way to the burning god. And everybody salutes as he goes by, or she goes by, on the way to the burning god. And there's no, which we have, which is the minute the person dies, they disappear into the big void beyond. The sheet goes over, and the whole thing is covered, and denial starts immediately. So hospice is doing a great deal just by training people to be compassionate listeners and psychologically able to hang out with people who are dying. My own work is a little further out than that. My work is for people who say, I would like to use my death as a vehicle for awakening. I would actually like to use the process of dying as a vehicle for awakening, since I have an understanding of the kinds of things you've been talking about. Now, you've got to understand that that tradition of using death in that way is understood by more people in the world today than there are who don't understand that. I mean, we're talking about China, we're talking about India, we're talking about Japan, we're talking about all of the Eastern countries. So for such a person, one sits down and one is first very straight. There's no hiding, there's no deception of anything. Your own fear, out in the open. We share it very straight. But in addition, we are working on ourselves to create a space, an environment, in which a person can experience the deeper parts of their being. And when they get to one level of it, where time isn't, then there's no more death. Sometimes I just go and I sit in a room with somebody who's dying and I merely sit there quietly with them. And they run all of their fear through me. And what comes back is peace. Because I don't have any fear of death that I can touch at the moment. To me, death is a process of just leaving what you thought you were. Not what you are, but what you thought you were. They run their fear through, and what comes back is peace, and they release a little bit. And then they run more fear through, and they get back peace. And they run more fear through, and they get back peace. Until you can just feel them. They're just like a flower, opening and extending and opening out. Until again and again, you're sitting with somebody who is in incredible pain and suffering, and you're saying, oh, it's so beautiful. I'm feeling such peace. And at the same moment, the ravages of cancer or extreme heart conditions or whatever, Hodgkin's disease. I was working with a boy who just died 2 weeks ago. And I would come in each time, and he would be agitated and irritated, and he had bed sores, and there was a lot of pain and suffering. I'd wash him and help change him and just be with him. But at the same moment, I was just being quiet inside my own being. In other words, I wasn't coming on to him. I wasn't saying, you ought to go deeper in yourself. I wasn't hustling him. I was merely working on myself in his presence. The result of that was that very slowly he started to let go of identifying with the body, identifying with the pain, the psychological part, and started to experience just a spaciousness, in which he could see death. Death comes, birth comes, life comes, growth comes. For you to be of any use to someone that is dying, for me to be of any use, there is one simple rule. You work on yourself. You don't work on the other person. We have a model that is so deeply ingrained in us often as professionals. You are healing someone else. You're doing for the old people. You're doing for the young people. You're doing for the dying people. I have a very simple rule in my life, work on myself. Because all I can offer to you or to a dying person or to a marital problem or to some child, I can only offer my being. And my being is the result of everything I've done in my life to get to where I am. That's all I have to offer. But if you can flip through those channels, that love is not conditional love. It's not based on individual differences. It's merely the love because you're seeing the divine plan made manifest again. Every moment of your life, once you understand the purpose of it, is your vehicle for awakening. This moment is your vehicle for awakening. If you're uncomfortable at this moment, okay, you're uncomfortable. Allow it. If you're fascinated, be fascinated. Allow it. Give it space. Give it space. Imagine a picture. And the picture is a picture of a cloud. And if the cloud fills the whole picture frame, all you see is cloud. And you're totally immersed in the cloud. But allow a little teeny bit of blue sky around the edge of the cloud. And then imagine identifying with the blue sky instead of the cloud. From that point, you can say, ah, cloud. The difference between I'm depressed, versus, wow, am I depressed? Or, I'm depressed versus, look at that depression. Whew. Boy, I don't think I'll ever get through that one. Wow, that's a heavy one. Boy, that's the worst depression I've ever seen. I don't think people live through those times. Now, the second kind I'm doing is showing the ability to keep a sense of humor in the middle of the depression. Well, if you've got a sense of humor, how depressed could you be? But that's the issue. It's the issue of the tiny bit of spaciousness that surrounds the identity with the happenings of life, the experiences of life. It is said in the spirit mystic literature, one to me is loss and gain. One to me is fame and shame. One to me is pleasure and pain. Meaning, there's fame. Hello, Ram Dass. That's fame. Ram who? Das, did you say? Don Das, yes. Oh, you're that horrible guy that was, ugh, that shame. Oh, just won the lottery? That's gain. Wallet just stolen? Loss. Pleasure. Oh, my darling, come here. Oh, my leg hurts. Each one, they take you completely, get lost in it, on somebody who has a hurt leg. Versus, here I am, and there's a leg that hurts. The predicament is that most of us don't want this kind of consciousness. Because we don't want to lose the rushes or the trips of life. We don't want to forego the romanticism. We don't want to forego the rush that comes from identifying with our own melodrama. And that kind of equanimity, that kind of quietness, that kind of spaciousness, that kind of presence, that kind of compassion for oneself and for all things, because from a quiet, clear place, you see how it all is without pushing or pulling. For it is only the non-attached mind that can truly appreciate how it is. Otherwise, you're just seeing the projections of your own desires. If you're hungry and you go down the street, you will notice restaurants. If your car is making a strange knock, you will notice gas stations. And that is what your universe is full of. Because you and I are living in entirely different universes, because each individual is living in a universe selecting from the possible infinity of things, those things which lock in with your own desire system. So if you identify with a desire, that will determine what you see in the world. When you get to the point that you can allow a desire system without identifying with it, sure, I have lust. Sure, I have greed. Sure, I have fear. Sure, I have depression. But here I am. I am. I am, and there's an aging body, and I am, and there's depression, and I am, and there's hope, and I am, and there's planning, and I am, and there's death. How different the state. That's because the television channels, you're living on more than one of them simultaneously. You're starting to live on all of them, all at once. There are some very heavy processes that occur at the time of death. And the Tibetan Buddhists, for example, understood that the meaning of life was the preparation for death. You were preparing to stay conscious through these incredibly heavy processes that happen. Heavy process, example. A fellow called me the other day. His mother just died. He's a meditator. He's a Buddhist. He sat with her through the process. He said at first she protested, then she acquiesced. He said, then it got to the point where she was too weak to eat, so I had to feed her. Then it got to the point where she lost her sphincter control and her bowel control, and I found myself carrying her to the toilet with her feces dripping down my leg. And that was a hard one for us. And then it got to the point where all of her unconscious processes started to rise to the surface. And I found in the middle of the night sometimes she would be calling to me, and I'd go over and she'd start to make love to me. All of the Oedipal stuff was coming up. And he said, and through it all, we still kept the thread. We still kept the thread of consciousness with one another. It's not the physical death that's so scary, it's the psychological death. It's the ceasing to be who you think you are. The thread was held. And I have been now with many people and just holding them as they die. And being right with them, looking in their eyes as the spirit just leaves, as they just leave, and the last breath occurs and the eyes glaze over, and the being just leaves. And it's just a release, an opening. Because by the time they got to that moment, they were no longer clinging to that which dies. Don't be silly. Where could I go? There's no more clinging to that which dies. For who we are was, is, and will be. And these are just processes of transformation that we're going through. Just like it's very hard for a prepubescent to understand the time will come when his baseball cards aren't that relevant. So the time will come when even our mortal coil isn't that relevant. If you will just imagine somebody who has died, and they died in the Western, I'll give you two people. One has died in the Western metaphor, see, so they're busy not dying. Doctor, save me, transplant me, implant me, do whatever you do, but don't let me die. But you're dead, then you die. And a voice says to you, hello. And you say, well, if I can hear a voice saying hello, I guess I didn't die. The voice says, no, you died. You say, well, I can't have died. And that's confusion. It's called purgatory in Christianity. And you just sort of hang in that place, and then you get reprogrammed into the next round. But now, as you go through incarnation after incarnation, on and on and on and on, somewhere along in the sequence of these, you begin to awaken just a little bit. And you get to the point where you begin to hear what I'm talking about. You begin to see, wow, far out, that's all that happens when you die. So as you're dying this time, instead of doctor, doctor, you say, wow, this is going to be great. Here we go. Ready? Put on your safety belt. Here I go. Ready or not? Oh, wow. Ooh. Now you're dead. Somebody says hello, and you say hi. Now you're in a new predicament. You're still somebody. You're not nobody yet. You haven't finished your rounds of birth and death. So you're going to take another incarnation because you've got more stuff to do. You've got to go through more experiences. So you have a list of things you've got to go through, see. You say, gee, if I did it right, I could clean up all of these in one birth. See, if I took birth as a child of the poorest tribe in Africa, that would be good, because I clean up that one. That was the one I got from being that king 50 births ago when I misused that. And let's see, if I get raped when I'm 9. That'll be beautiful. That would take care of that one. See. And then, see, I'll get syphilis at 13. I could die at 17 and clean the whole thing up. Far out. Okay. So now you've got a problem. You're all ready to do this. You've got your plan, and you put a little sign on you saying, this is all just a scenario. This isn't reality. You put a little sign on it, and the sign says, I am somebody who wants to take this birth looking for two other people who need me, you know, karmically like I need them, you know. And the computers were and all kinds of things happen, and within a million or two Earth years, something comes up. Doesn't matter, you know, it's going on anyway. And these two people say, let's have a baby, or there's a moment of passion, and there you are. And as you're being born, you say to everybody, well, see you later. And you dive into Earth, and you go, wah, wah, and you're a baby. Veil over. You were a baby. That's all your reality is, a baby. 9 years old, you're raped, 13, syphilis, 17, you die. Ah, no, I don't want to die, You're dead, you come up. Hi, back so soon. Right, well, that cleaned up all those five now. Is that too gross for you? From where I'm sitting, I've got to up-level it just one bit by just saying to you that the reality that lies behind all these relative realities, there is no time. All your reincarnations are happening simultaneously. That's a little heavy for you, but you got to understand that it's not like it's spread out like Brady Murphy, like you with that 40 years ago. It's all here now, all your incarnations. So that when you get all done with the last one, you realize nothing happened anyway. I mean, I'm pushing your mind all over the place. If you could see the universe that way, what would be the difference in the meaning of death? Well, I'm finishing chapter 3. Now, I'm not saying that you should have a mind intellectual overlay that makes everything different that way, not a dishonest imposition of intellect. But for anybody that will subject themselves to simply sitting down quietly and learning how to quiet their mind by allowing the thoughts to come and go, just as simple a thing as following your breath. Just take 2 minutes now. Bring your awareness to your breath. Just notice the breath.